Mr. Thomas Coyne, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
You were present at Dr. Martin Luther King's address here at Western Michigan University 4 months after he gave his historic I Have a Dream speech in Washington, D.C. What was your role here at Western at that time?
At that time, I was the director of alumni relations, and I was the advisor to the senior class. That's a significant thing in terms of its background.
Give me that background.
The background of Dr. King's speech is, I think, sometimes overlooked, and unfortunately overlooked, because he came at a very significant time in world history, U.S. history, not to mention the history of Western Michigan University. In 1963, as the school year began, the senior class was a very active group, much more active than we realized. And I've realized it when I received a phone call one morning from President James W. Miller asking me, why was Governor Ross Barnett of the state of Mississippi being invited to speak at the Western Michigan University campus, which he had just announced? And I said, I didn't know a thing about it. He said, the senior class has apparently invited him. I told the president I'd find out what I could immediately, and did. Turned out that the senior class, a very active group of young men and women, led by President Tom Ruschkamp, had decided that they wanted to have significant speakers on the campus. And so they contacted by mail some 30 figures who were in the news. One of those figures in the news, very much in the news, was the voice of the leading face, so to speak, of segregation in the United States, Governor Ross Barnett of Mississippi. He had, in the year previous, tried to deny the enrollment of James Meredith to the University of Mississippi. He was clearly one of the most rabid segregationists in the country. But he was in the news, so the students wanted to hear him speak. And he accepted. Of all the 30 that were sent, he's the only one who accepted. And the president, James Miller, took a great deal of heat, great deal of pressure from local people, the local heads of the NAACP, local government officials, and then up into the state level, including up into Governor Romney's office.
Sorry, were you the senior class advisor?
I was the advisor.
But you didn't know that they had done this.
I was blindsided entirely. I was very, very much surprised by this. But the president said, this is a student's invitation. They have the right to hear a speaker on this campus. He will come on according to our regulations, which mean that he will be subject to question and answer period. But I am not going to deny the students the right to bring in a speaker. This is a university. And he saw it as a teachable moment. And so even though he took a tremendous amount of pressure, including threats to cut university funding, lots of anger, he stood by the students, even though he had been blindsided as badly as I had. And as a result, Barnett came and spoke on campus.
Were there protests?
Actually, there was no protest. People came to hear him speak. There was a typical question and answer period of two faculty members and two students asked questions. They'd ask very good questions. The students in particular, I thought, were extremely articulate. And they really quizzed Governor Barnett on his stance on segregation.
Did any African-American students attend?
Oh, yes. They were, matter of fact, the President Miller sat in the front row with some of the leading NAACP figures in the city. So the African-American students were there, and frankly, at that time, were quite willing to have him come and speak. They wanted to see him. They wanted to hear him. They wanted him to be challenged by the students on this campus, and he was. But because of his speech, a number of our leading faculty members, led by Dr. Sam Clark, who was the founder of the Honors College, wanted to have other speakers on the other dimensions of this whole civil rights issue. And they set up a speaker series called The Conscience of America. And one of the first speakers that they wanted to get, of course, was Dr. Martin Luther King. Dr. King accepted. And although the first date that he was supposed to come, he was not able to come, he did arrive in December and did give his speech at the Fieldhouse. Unfortunately for Dr. King, he arrived in the midst of a raging snowstorm, which greatly reduced the attendance. We probably only had about 2,000 people in attendance. And
what's the capacity of the field house?
The capacity of the field house, the way they had it set up at that time, would have been about 5,000. It was set up for the main floor, not on the sides around. If you had everybody in the field house, you'd have, well, we used to put in there, even though the official capacity was 8,000, we'd put in about 10,000 for a football, basketball game.
Mr. Barrett, did he also speak at the field house?
No. He spoke, because the field house and the other venues were not present, he spoke in one of the smaller rooms in the gymnasium area.
And how many people did he attract?
He probably attracted a good 1,500 or more.
Okay, yeah. So a little bit more came for King.
Yeah, well, actually, they couldn't. It was all we could take. I mean, room space couldn't have taken any more than that. So there were people outside.
So there were people who were turned away.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, back to King.
The Dr. King came and presented the leading speech in this Conscience of America series. He was, I think, finally the only speaker who did come. But he gave a very measured address. I thought at the time, I think at the time still, that he was very grave, almost somber in his approach. He did not have in his talk the glowing eloquence that he used in the Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech that we hear so much about. And part of that, you know, was because in Washington, he deviated from his regular speech. That was an add-on that he put in at that moment. And I think Dr. King's memorable speeches are when he did that, when he moved into his I am a preacher mode, and he spoke from the heart to the people who are there as a preacher, as a teacher. And as a result, the people in D.C. received probably one of this country's most memorable speeches. But at Western, he was more on track, so to speak, more on target. And he was fairly somber. He was really probably more effective even in his question and answer period.
What stands out to you as simply someone who was there listening to him give this speech? What do you remember? And what stays with you?
I remember a couple of things. One, I remember the delight of Sam Clark and President James Miller. They had now someone to speak in contradiction and an explanation of this whole issue of civil rights versus segregation. I remember President Miller's initial comments to the students and to the audience present that the logical course of analysis is action. And Dr. King had been showing that action throughout the country in his efforts for civil rights. And he wanted that to be a lesson that the students would learn as well, that education was a sham unless it was a question of their taking that education and transforming it into an action. President Miller was delighted that he had a man of Dr. King's stature able to give those moments of instruction to students. And that was one of the main things I remember. I remember Dr. King's very measured comments in response to the questions that he was given afterwards. They use a little bit different format in the King speech as opposed to the Barnett speech. In the Barnett speech, they had two faculty members and two students asking questions on the platform. In the King speech, they had individuals passing out pencils and papers so they could write questions down. These were brought forward to Sam Clark and to President Miller, and then they would ask the questions of Dr. King. That was in an effort to kind of speed things up because Dr. King was on a very tight time frame. He had to leave the field house at a precise time in order to get back to the airport to get a plane back to D.C., so he was really running, and with the weather conditions being what they were, they didn't want to take any chances. So those The answers he gave, the questions were good questions, and he was particularly attentive. You could see him thinking clearly, what do I want to respond to this question?
You say that he was very measured in his responses to the questions, but you felt that he did, that it was more impactful, the question and answer period.
Yes.
Tell me what's the content of that you felt was so impactful?
One, his speech was a speech about the conscience of America. So he was trying to give a broad overview. The questions we're asking him were deliberate. What about this? What about that? What do you think about this particular issue? The question that stands out most clearly in my own mind, because it really was prophetic, not only about what he was talking about, but as it turned out, his own life. Dr. King was asked in one of the very last questions, what would be the impact of President Kennedy's death on the movement for civil rights and the Civil Rights Bill? Because President King had been assassinated.
This is just weeks
Kennedy
after
Kennedy had been assassinated. This is just in November, previous November. So King made a point of saying, and he had talked to, I presumed on this issue a number of times with President Johnson, that he thought that it was not unlikely that the movement would, the bill would go ahead and be successful, and that in fact President Kennedy might have been more successful after his death than he was before.
Why is that?
And when you realize it and you look at the impact of Dr. Martin Luther King himself after his assassination, and the impact that he has had on a number of individuals who have followed him and who have stepped into his footsteps, you begin to see that he really, although not, I'm sure, consciously, was reflecting his own life.
So would you agree that the movement was somehow, I hate to use the word helped, but that the movement advanced greater because of the deaths of these two men?
I very definitely do. I think that...
Why do you say that?
I think that President Kennedy, with his assassination, has again achieved an almost mythic stature. But what he was fighting for, and at that time he was fighting for it, President Kennedy moved slowly into the civil rights movement. He did not move rapidly. He was pushed along by men by Harris, like Harris Wolford and his brother Bobby, brother Teddy. But he was conscious of the forthcoming election in 64. He'd had a very narrow election in 60. And so he was moving with a certain amount of political caution that his advisors, Harris and Bobby and Teddy were not really willing to get. They wanted to move much more quickly, and so did the civil rights leaders. But he was moving. Now he was moving in that direction, and it was known that he was moving in that direction. And as a result, when President Johnson came into office, he immediately took up those challenges and brought them forward in President Kennedy's name. And he was able to do, using Kennedy's example, Kennedy's martyrdom, so to speak, as a way of forcing the American people to say, now we have to rise up and meet the challenge of our dead president. And he was, I think, as a result, much more successful. I don't think, had President Kennedy been alive and fighting this, quote-unquote, as a political battle, it would have been as easy to do. He probably would have been successful, but I don't think it would have been as easy to do.
And you're saying that because you feel that somehow emotions were higher
with
the deaths of King and...
And the sympathy for what the man stood for.
Mm-hmm. And JFK. Tell me, when you met, not that you personally met Dr. King, but when you heard him, did you have a full appreciation for who he was at the time? Often history can be somewhat I don't know what word I want to use, revisionist, or somehow when one reflects back on a historical figure, somehow they have greater significance. For example, I don't know, years from now, will we look at the Reverend Al Sharpton as some great somebody? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Sometimes people take for granted the leaders that are in front of them. You, having lived through that time and heard King, did you have a full appreciation of the weight of who he was at that time? Or was he just another civil rights person in the same way that today we listen to another civil rights person?
He was not another civil rights person. He had grown in that position. He was when he started. In fact, he was pushed into it by a number of men who have been lost to history, but who in their own right deserve a great deal of recognition. But he had grown in the position as a civil rights leader, and he was a real leader, and he came across as a real leader. He was, as I remarked earlier, very grave, and that seemed to be more his mannerism. And you couldn't really blame him. I mean, he was under a lot of pressure. He was constantly tugged at here, there, everywhere where people wanted him. He was trying to do the right thing, and he was struggling against a recalcitrant society and moving them slowly in the right way. He was preaching the doctrine of nonviolence very, very steadily, and he was acting as a mature, dignified leader. There wasn't any question that he was not a firebrand. He was an eloquent leader.
Often, and it's to be understood that sometimes people changing, how should I say, during a certain time in history, people may have a certain opinion about race, certainly at that time. And over time, you know, one's feelings change. So the question I would ask is, for you personally, I don't know where you felt on the issue of civil rights at the time. And then after hearing King, was there anything transformative about that? Did you notice any change in your own thinking as a result of hearing him?
No, King's speech did not change me, because I had been on that side for a long, long time. Remember,
and the I'm side from, being
the civil rights side. Mm-hmm. I was clearly in favor of that, and had been from high school days. I grew up in Chicago. There are lots of segregated and racially charged areas in Chicago. There are a lot of areas that are not. And I had the benefit of having had a grade school and high school education, St. Christopher's Grade School and St. Ignatius High School in Chicago. The Jesuits in St. Ignatius were clear and distinct about their opinions as to what was correct in civil rights. And they very clearly made those of us who were at the school understand this is coming and this is the right thing. So I was not at all in a situation where I was coming out of that kind of segregationist background. The people you had to really feel sympathy for were the young men and women who had been brought up in a society which was racially segregated. I had not. They had been, when you come up in a society where the older adults implicitly tell you this is allowed, this is good, this is all right, this is what the Bible tells us as the young men and women down in the so-called Bible Belt of this country were taught. For them to make the realization that, no, this is wrong, this is not right, it's a huge change for them. And since I grew up in a society where, in an area where that was not accepted, not in my household and not in the households of the people that I associated with, it wasn't that difficult for me to be part and parcel of the belief that Dr. King spoke for was the correct thing to do.
Were there any protests at his
No,
address?
Actually, the only protest an even mild kind of protest that you saw was a letter to the editor of the Herald a couple of weeks later.
The Western Herald.
The Western Herald. saying, how come they wouldn't let us ask the questions directly? Why did President Miller and Sam Clark want to read the questions? The kids wanted to, they wanted the dialogue with Dr. King. And probably he would have been very delighted to do that.
What do you recall was the conversation or banter on campus after his visit? What really did people say behind closed doors? What did the administrators say behind closed doors? What do you know of what students might have said at that time, being that you were the advisor to the senior class, you say?
The students were interested only in notoriety. We had two of the leading figures on the major issue in this country at this time on our campus. They were delighted. They had a chance to hear from a segregationist and from a great civil rights leader. That was what impressed them as much as anything else. I don't think the general mood of the Western Michigan University was anything other than supportive of civil rights. I would have been amazed to have seen any significant segregationist feeling on this campus. Now, there were over the years and subsequent years a number of tense times with the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, the rise of the black student movement. There were a number of issues. There were takeovers of the students at Bernhardt, what is now the Bernhardt Student Center. And those issues occurred. Those issues made people face more directly the issues of segregation, the issues of racial division, etc. But in the main, the students of Western Michigan University were, I would say, clearly supportive of the concept of civil rights.
I do have a question that you were talking about the backstory of what brought King here, and you were talking about Ross Barnett. You know, it was actually his appearance here that actually led to the invitation for King to be here. And I'm trying to kind of wrap my mind around that. You were here, so you can kind of clarify. What did that say about the students that they would want to bring him here, meaning Mr. Barnett at the time? Was it really a sense of wanting to really open up dialogue on that issue, or that's kind of a tough concept. I'm kind of wondering, like, would the modern day equivalent of that be bringing a representative of the KKK here? I'm just trying to figure it out. Help me.
Okay.
Help our listeners.
Okay, and I'm going to go back before that because I want to finish up the answer to the previous question. Earlene, you're not that far removed from the student years, your student years. Students did not focus at all on this as an issue of segregation or or an issue of civil rights or an issue of are we going to bomb somebody. They were interested in the people who were in the news. They would have invited Attila the Hun if Attila the Hun had been in the leading newspapers at the time. They were sent out letters to 30 people who were most prominent in the news. They were interested in, let's get somebody who is controversial, who is
they're being students
in the newspaper. They didn't care. They actually benefited in a way they didn't understand. And Jim Miller saw that as a possibility to make it a beneficial movement, a teachable moment. They didn't really understand the issues of the segregation civil rights dispute as well before those invitations went out as they did after. Now they had suddenly said, you know, we actually had on campus something that was going on right now and that affects us right now. And inadvertently, in an effort to get notoriety, they got intelligence and education.
Very good. Speaking of which, intelligence and education, we have this event coming up on December 2nd at noon at Western Michigan University that commemorates the 50th anniversary of King's visit here. And you're going to be among the panelists. You'll be able to...
I don't know, but we'll see.
You're hoping?
We'll see what happens.
All right. You're hoping, perhaps, that you'll be on it. I guess more to the point, what I'm trying to get at is, why should people come to that? Why present day? Why would they want to be at that event?
That was such a significant part of American history that our relatively small segment of it, Dr. King spoke at a lot of different places, but he spoke here, and he spoke on that issue, and he spoke on that issue at a time when it was still a vital issue. The tendency in society is to forget significant things happened to make the smooth society exist that we now enjoy. A lot of people suffered and died because of the civil rights movement. A lot of people. People were killed when James Meredith tried to enroll at the University of Mississippi. They didn't intend to die. Both of them apparently were killed, and neither one of them was a figure in the issue. But people died as a result of the Freedom Bus Rides. That was a significant period in American history. And if we forget history, if we forget the sacrifices that a great many very ordinary people, not orators like Dr. King, not people like Young, and not people like Rosa Parks, but ordinary people who day to day just do ordinary things, but in those ordinary things, they carry on the traditions of a civil, free society that is in America today. It's a learning opportunity. It's a lesson you continually relearn. It's not a lesson you learn and you have it and you forget it. You have to relearn that lesson, how to treat people. And this particular remembrance of Dr. King's visit is a good way to do that.
How is race relations right now? That'll be the final question. How is race relations now in America?
I think they clearly are better in the sense of more opportunity. They're probably not as good in the sense of people of different races and creeds honestly talking to each other. That still hasn't happened. And it hasn't, and I can remember people remarking that in years past, and I see it as still true. We are polite. We are, I think, sensitive. But we don't necessarily sit down and really have an honest discussion. You know what you do here, you really irritate me. And what I do here, you don't tell me what I do, really irritates you. That kind of open discussion between friends doesn't take place as frequently as we'd like. It takes place more than it used to, but it's never going to take place frequently enough.
Thank you, Mr. Coyne, for joining us.
Okay.